as they came up the gut, and the huge, beautiful Spanish first-rates moving along with the inevitability of the sun. The masons went off to their dinner. The wind backed westerly. The shadow of the tower swept through 25 degrees. When they had rounded Cabrita Point, the Superb and the frigate carried straight on for Gibraltar, while the Spaniards hauled their wind for Algeciras. And now Jack could see that their flagship was indeed the Real Carlos, of 112 guns, one of the most powerful ships afloat, that one of the other three-deckers was of the same force, and the third of 96. It was a most formidable squadron. 474 great guns, without counting the 100-odd of the frigates. And the ships were surprisingly well handled. They anchored over there under the guns of the Spanish batteries as trimly as though they were to be reviewed by the king. "Hello, sir," said Mowat. "I thought you'd be up here. I've brought you a cake." "Why, thank ye," cried Jack. "I'm devilish hungry, I find." He at once cut a slice and ate it up. "How extraordinarily the navy had changed," he thought, cutting another. When he was a midshipman, it would never in 1,000 years have occurred to him to speak to his captain, far less bring him cakes. And if it had occurred to him, he would never have done so for fear of his life. "May I share your rock, sir?" asked Mowat, sitting down. "They've come to fetch the Frenchman out, I do suppose. Do you think we shall go for him, sir?"
"Pompey'll never be fit for sea these 3 weeks," said Jack dubiously. "Caesar's cruelly knocked about and must get all her new masts in. But even if they can get her ready before the enemy sail, that only gives us 5 of the line against 10, or 9 if you leave the Hannibal out. 376 guns to their 700-odd, both their squadrons combined. We're short-handed, too."
"You'd go for them, would you not, sir?" said Babington, and both the midshipmen laughed very cheerfully. Jack gave a jerk of his head, and Mowat said, "As when enclosing harpooners assail, in Hyperborean seas the slumbering whale." What huge things these Spaniards are! The Caesars have petitioned to be allowed to work all day and night, sir. Captain Brenton says they may work all day, but only watch and watch at night. They're piling up juniper wood fires on the mole to have light. It was by the light of these juniper fires that Jack ran into Captain Keats of the Superb, with 2 of his lieutenants and a civilian. After the first surprise, greetings, introductions. Captain Keats asked him to take supper aboard. They were going back now. Only a scrap meal, of course, but some genuine Hampshire cabbage brought straight from Captain Keats' own garden by the Astrea. "It's very kind of you indeed, sir, most grateful, but I believe I must beg to be excused. I had the misfortune to lose the Sophie, and I dare say you will be sitting on me presently, together with most of the other post-captains."
"Oh," said Captain Keats, suddenly embarrassed.
"Captain Aubrey is quite right," said the civilian in a sententious voice. And at that moment an urgent messenger called Captain Keats to the Admiral. "Who was that ill-looking son of a bitch in the black coat?" asked Jack, as another friend, Heneage Dundas of the Calpe, came down the steps.
"Coke?
Why, he's the new Judge Advocate," said Dundas with a queer look. Or was it a queer look? The trick of the flames could give anyone a queer look. The words of the 10th Article of War came quite unbidden into his mind. "If any person in the fleet shall cowardly yield or cry for quarter, being convicted thereof by the sentence of a court-martial, shall suffer death." "Come and split a bottle of port with me at the Blue Posts, Heneage," said Jack, drawing his hand across his face.
"Jack," said Dundas, "there is nothing I should like better upon my oath, but I have promised Brenton to give him a hand. I'm on my way this minute. There's the rest of my party staying for me."
He hurried off into the brighter light along the mole, and Jack drifted away. Dark, steep alleys, low brothels, smells, squalid drinking shops. The next day, under the lee of the Charles V wall, with his telescope resting on a stone, and with a certain sense of spying or eavesdropping, he watched the Caesar, no longer the flagship, being eased alongside the sheer hulk to receive her new lower mainmast, 100 feet long and more than a yard across. She got it in so quickly that the top was over before noon, and neither it nor the deck could be seen for the number of men working on the rigging. The day after that, still from his melancholy height, full of guilt at his idleness and the intense, ordered busyness below, particularly about the Caesar, he saw the San Antonio, a French 74 that had been delayed, come in from Cadiz and anchor among her friends at Algeciras. The next day there was great activity on the far side of the bay, boats plying to and fro among the 12 ships of the combined fleet, new sails bending, supplies coming aboard, hoist after hoist of signals aboard the flagships. And all this activity was reproduced in Gibraltar, with even greater zeal. There was no hope for the Pompey, but the Audacious was almost entirely ready, while the Venerable, the Spencer, and of course the Superb were in fighting trim, and the Caesar was so near the final stages of her refitting that it was just possible she might be fit for sea in 24 hours. During the night, a hint of a levanter began to breathe from the east. This was the wind the Spaniards were praying for, the wind that would carry them straight out of the gut once they had weathered Cabrita Point and waft them up to Cadiz. At noon, the first of their three-deckers loosed her foretopsail and began to move out of the crowded road. Then the others followed her. They were weighing and coming out at intervals of 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour to their rendezvous off Cabrita Point. The Caesar was still tied up alongside the mole, taking in her powder and shot with officers, men, civilians, and garrison soldiers working with silent, concentrated earnestness. At length, the whole of the combined fleet was underway. Even their jury-rigged capture, the Hannibal, towed by the French frigate Indienne, was creeping out to the point. And now the shrill, squeaking fife and fiddle broke out aboard the Caesar, as her people manned the capstan bars and began to warp her out of the mole, taut, trim, and ready for war. A thundering cheer ran all along the crowded shore from the batteries, walls, and hillside black with spectators. And when it died away, there was the garrison band playing "Come cheer up, my lads, 'tis to glory we steer," as loud as ever they could go, while the Caesar's marines answered with "Britain's strike home." Through the cacophony the fife could still be heard. It was most poignantly moving. As the Caesar passed under the stern of the Audacious, she hoisted Sir James's flag once more, and immediately afterwards heaved out the signal "Weigh and prepare for battle." The execution of this was perhaps the most beautiful naval manoeuvre Jack had ever seen. They had all been waiting for the signal. They were all waiting and ready with their cables up and down. And in an unbelievably short space of time the anchors were catted, and the masts and yards broke out in tall white pyramids of sail as the squadron, 5 ships of the line, 2 frigates, a sloop and a brig, moved out of the lee of the rock and formed in line ahead on the larboard tack. Jack pushed his way out of the tight-packed crowd on the milehead, and he was halfway to the hospital, meaning to persuade Stephen to mount the rock with him, when he saw his friend running swiftly through the deserted streets. "Has she got out of the mole?" cried Stephen at a considerable distance. "Has the battle begun?" Reassured, he said, "I wouldn't have missed it for 100 pounds. That damn fellow in Ward B in his untimely fancies. A fine time to cut one's throat, good luck-a-day."
"There's no hurry. No one will touch a gun for hours," said Jack. "But I'm sorry you didn't see the Caesar warping out. It was a glorious sight.
Come up the hill with me, and you'll have a perfect view of both squadrons. Do come. I'll call in at the house and pick up a couple of telescopes. And a cloak. It grows cold at night."
"Very well," said Stephen, after a moment's thought. "I can leave a note, and we will fill our pockets with ham. Then we shall have none of your wry looks and short answers."
"There they lay," said Jack, pausing for breath again, "still on the larboard tack."
"I see them perfectly well," said Stephen, 100 yards ahead and climbing fast. "Pray do not stop so often. Come on."
"Oh, Lord, oh, Lord," said Jack at last, sinking under his familiar rock. "How quick you go. Well, there they are.
Aye, there they are. A noble spectacle indeed. But why are they standing over towards Africa? And why only courses and topsails with this light breeze? That one's even backing her main topsail. She's the Superb. She does so to keep her station and not overrun the Admiral, for she's a superb sailor, you know, the best in the fleet."
"Did you hear that?"
"Yes.
It was rather clever, I thought.
Witty. Why do they not make sail and bear up?"
"Oh, there's no question of a head-on encounter. Probably no action at all by daylight. It would be downright madness to attack their line of battle at this time. The Admiral wants the enemy to get out of the bay and into the gut, so there will be no doubling back, and so that he'll have sea room to make a dash at them. Once they get well into the offing, I dare say he'll try to cut off their rear if this wind holds, and it looks like a true 3-day Levanter. Look there, the Hannibal cannot weather the point, do you see? She'll be on shore directly. The frigate's making sad work of it. They're towing her head round. Handsomely does it. There we are. She fills.
Set the jib, man.
Just so. She's going back." They sat watching in silence, and all around them they could hear other groups, scattered all over the surface of the rock. Remarks about the strengthening of the wind, the probable strategy to be observed, the exact broadside weight of metal on either side, the high standard of French gunnery, the currents to be met with off Cape Trafalgar. With a good deal of backing and filling, the combined fleet, now 9 ships of the line and 3 frigates, had formed their line of battle, with the 2 great Spanish first rates in the rear, and now they bore away due westwards before the freshening breeze. A little before this, the British squadron had worn together by signal, and now they were on the starboard tack under easy sail. Jack's telescope was firmly on the flagship, and as soon as he saw the hoist running up, he murmured, "Here we go." The signal appeared. At once, the press of canvas almost doubled, and within a few minutes the squadron was racing away after the French and the Spaniards, dwindling, in his view, growing smaller every moment as he watched.
"Oh, God, how I wish I were with them,"
said Jack, with a groan of something like despair. And some 10 minutes later, "Look, they're Superb going ahead. The Admiral must have hailed her." The Superb's t'gallant studding-sails appeared, as though by magic, port and starboard.
"How she flies," said Jack, lowering his glass and wiping it.
But the dimness was neither his tears nor any dirt on the glass. It was the fading of the day. Down below, it had already gone. A tawny late evening filled the town, and lights were breaking out all over it. Presently, lanterns could be seen creeping up the rock to the high points from which perhaps the battle might be seen. And over the water, Algeciras began to twinkle, a low-lying curve of lights. "What do you say to some of that ham?" said Jack. Stephen said he thought ham might prove a valuable preservative against the falling damps.
And when they had been eating for some time in the darkness, with their pocket handkerchiefs spread upon their knees, he suddenly observed, "They tell me I am to be tried for the loss of the Sophie." Jack hadn't thought of the court-martial since early that morning, when it became certain that the combined fleet was coming out. Now it came back to him with an extraordinarily unpleasant shock, quite closing his stomach. However, he only replied, "Who told you that?" "The physical gentleman at the hospital, I suppose." "Yes." "Theoretically they're right, of course. The thing is officially called the trial of the captain, officers and ship's company, and they formally ask the officers if they have any complaints to make against the captain, and the captain whether he has any to make against the officers. But obviously, and this is only my conduct that is in question, you have nothing to worry about, I do assure you. Upon my word and honour, nothing at all." "Oh, I shall plead guilty at once," said Stephen. "And I shall add that I was sitting in the powder magazine with a naked light at the time, imagining the death of the king, wasting my medical stores, smoking tobacco, and making a fraudulent return of the portable soup." "What solemn nonsense it is," laughing heartily. "I'm surprised so sensible a man as you should attribute any importance to the matter." "Oh, I don't mind it," cried Jack. "How you lie," said Stephen affectionately, but within his own bosom. After a longish pause, Jack said, "You don't rate post-captains and admirals very high among intelligent beings, I believe. I've heard you say some tolerably severe things about admirals and great men in general. Why, to be sure, something sad seems to happen to your great men and your admirals with age pretty often, even to your post-captains. A kind of atrophy, a withering away of the head and the heart. I conceive it may arise from..." "Well," said Jack, laying his hand upon his friend's dimly seen shoulder in the starlight, "how would you like to place your life, your profession, and your good name between the hands of a parcel of senior officers?" "Oh!" cried Stephen. But what he had to say was never heard, for away on the horizon towards Tangiers there was a flash, 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 not unlike the repeated dart of lightning. They leapt to their feet and cupped their ears to the wind to catch the distant roar. But the wind was too strong, and presently they sat down again, fixing the western sea with their telescopes. They could distinctly make out two sources between 20 and 25 miles away, scarcely any distance apart, not above a degree. Then three, then a fourth and fifth, and then a growing redness that didn't move. "There's a ship on fire," said Jack in horror, his heart pumping so hard that he could scarcely keep the steady deep red glow in his object glass. "I hope to God it's not one of ours. I hope to God they drowned the magazines." An enormous flash lit the sky, dazzled them, put out the stars. And nearly 2 minutes later, the vast, solemn, long, rumbling boom of explosion reached them, prolonged by its own echo off the African shore. "What was it?" asked Stephen at last. "The ship blew up," said Jack. His mind was filled with the Battle of the Nile and the long moment when Lorient exploded, all brought back to him with extraordinary vividness. 100 details he thought forgotten, some very hideous. And he was still among those memories when a second explosion shattered the darkness, perhaps even greater than the first. After this, nothing. Not the remotest light, not a gun flash. The wind increased steadily, and the rising moon put out the smaller stars. After a while, some of the lanterns began to go down. Others remained, and some even climbed higher still. Jack and Stephen stayed where they were. Dawn found them under their rock, with Jack steadily sweeping the gut, calm now and deserted, and Stephen Maturin fast asleep, smiling. Not a word, not a sign. A silent sea, a silent sky, and the wind grown treacherous again. All round the compass. At 7:30, Jack saw Stephen back to the hospital, revived himself with coffee, and climbed again. In his journeys up and down, he came to know every wind in the path, and the rock against which he leaned was as familiar as an old coat. It was when he was going up after tea on Thursday, with his supper in a sailcloth bag, that he saw Dalziel, Boughton of the Hannibal, and Marshall bounding down the steep slope so fast that they couldn't stop. They called out, "Calpe's coming in, sir," and blundered on with the little dog running round and round them, very nearly bringing them down and barking with delight. Heneage Dundas of the fast-sailing sloop Calpe was an amiable young man, much caressed by those who knew him for his shining parts and particularly for his skill in the mathematics. But never before had he been the best-loved man in Gibraltar. Jack broke through the crowd surrounding him with brutal force and an unscrupulous use of his weight and his elbows. 5 minutes later he broke out again and ran like a boy through the streets of the town. "Stephen!" he cried, bursting open the door, his shining face far larger and higher than usual. "Victory! Come out at once and drink to a victory! Give you joy of a famous victory, old cock!" he cried, shaking him terribly by the hand. "Such a magnificent fight!" "Why, what happened?" asked Stephen, slowly wiping his scalpel and covering up his Moorish hyena. "Come on, and I'll tell you as we drink," said Jack, leading him into the street full of people, all talking eagerly, laughing, shaking hands, and beating one another on the back. Down by the new mole there was the sound of cheering. "Come on! I have a thirst like Achilles. No, Andromache. It's Keats has the glory of the day. Keats has borne the bell away." "That was a famous line, was it not? In here, Pedro, bear a hand there. Pedro, champagne! Here's to the victory. Here's to Keats and the superb. Here's to Admiral Samaras. Pedro, another bottle. Here's to the victory again. 3 times 3, huzzah!" "You would oblige me extremely by just giving the news," said Stephen, "with all the details." "I don't know all the details," said Jack, "but this is the gist of it. That noble fellow Keats, you remember how we saw him shoot ahead, came up with their rear, the two Spanish first rates, just before midnight. He chose his moment, clapped his helm a lee, and dashed between them, firing both broadsides. A 74 taking on 2 first rates. He shot straight on, leaving his smoke cloud between them as thick as pea soup, and each, firing into it, hit the other. And so the Real Carlos and the Hermenegildo went for each other like fury in the dark. Someone, the Superb, or the Hermenegildo, had knocked away the Real Carlos foretopmast, and it was her topsail that fell over the guns and took fire. And after a while, the Real Carlos fell on board the Hermenegildo and fired her too. Those were the two explosions we saw, of course. But while they were burning, Keats had pushed on to engage the San Antonio, who hauled her wind and fought back like a rare plucked'un, but she had to strike in 30 minutes, for, do you see, Superb was firing 3 broadsides to her 2 and pointing 'em straight. So Keats took possession of her, and the rest of the squadron chased as hard as ever they could to the nor'west in a gale of wind. They very nearly took the Formidable, but she just got into Cadiz, and we very nearly lost the Venerable, dismasted and aground, but they got her off, and she's on her way back now, jury-rigged, with a stunsail boom for a mizzenmast. Ha, 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 there's Dalziel and Marshall going by. Ahoy, Dalziel! Ahoy, Marshall! Ahoy there! Come and drink a glass to the victory!
The flag broke out aboard the Pompeii. The gun boomed. The captains assembled for the court-martial. It was a very grave occasion. And in spite of the brilliance of the day, the abounding cheerfulness on shore, and the deep, chuckling contentment aboard, each post-captain put away his gaiety and came up the side as solemn as a judge, to be greeted with all due ceremony and led into the great cabin by the first lieutenant. Jack was already aboard, of course, but his was not the first case to be dealt with. Waiting there in the screened-off larboard part of the dining cabin, there was a chaplain, a hunted-looking man who paced up and down, sometimes making private ejaculations and dashing his hands together. It was pitiful to see how carefully he was dressed, and how he had shaved until the blood came, for if half the general report of his conduct was true, there was no hope for him at all. The moment the next gun sounded, the master-at-arms took the chaplain away, and there was a pause. One of those great lapses of time that presently come to have no flow at all, but grow stagnant or even circular in motion. The other officers talked in low voices. They too were dressed with particular attention, in the exact uniform regularity that plenty of prize money and the best Gibraltar outfitters could provide. Was it respect for the court? For the occasion? A residual sense of guilt? A placating of fate? They spoke quietly, equably, glancing at Jack from time to time. They had each received an official notification the day before, and for some reason each had brought it with him, folded or rolled. After a while, Babington and Ricketts took to changing all the words they could into obscenities, secretly, in a corner, while Mowat wrote and scratched out on the back of his, counting syllables on his fingers and silently mouthing. Lukoch stared straight ahead of him into vacancy. Stephen intently watched the busy, unsatisfied questing of a shining dark-red rat flea on the checkered sailcloth floor. The door opened. Jack returned abruptly to this world, picked up his laced hat and walked into the great cabin, ducking his head as he came in, with his officers filing in behind him. He came to a halt in the middle of the room, tucked his hat under his arm, and made his bow to the court, first to the president, then to the captains to the right of him, then to the captains to the left of him. The president gave a slight inclination of his head, and desired Captain Aubrey and his officers to sit down. A marine placed a chair for Jack a few paces in front of the rest, and there he sat, his hand going to hitch forward his non-existent sword, while the judge-advocate read the document authorising the court to assemble. This took a considerable time, and Stephen looked steadily about him, examining the cabin from side to side. It was like a larger version of the Desaix's stateroom. How glad he was the Desaix was safe. And it, too, was singularly beautiful and full of light. The same range of curved stern windows, the same inward-leaning side walls, the ship's tumble-home, in fact, and the same close, massive, white-painted beams overhead in extraordinarily long, pure curves right across from one side to another. A room in which common domestic geometry had no say. At the far end from the door, parallel with the windows, ran a long table, and between the table and the light sat the members of the court. The president in the middle, the black-coated judge-advocate at a desk in front, and three post-captains on either side. There was a clerk at a small table on the left, and to the left again, a roped-off space for bystanders. The atmosphere was austere.
All the heads above the blue and gold uniforms on the far side of the shining table were grave. The last trial and the sentence had been quite shockingly painful. It was these heads, these faces, that had all Jack's attention. With the light behind them, it was difficult to make them out exactly, but they were mostly overcast, and all were withdrawn. Keats, Hood, Brenton, Grenville, he knew. Was Grenville winking at him with his one eye, or was it an involuntary blink? Of course it was a blink. Any signal would be grossly indecent. The president looked 20 years younger since the victory. But still his face was impassive, and there was no distinguishing the expression of his eyes behind those drooping lids. The other captains he knew only by name. One, a left-handed man, was drawing, scribbling. Jack's eyes grew dark with anger. The judge advocate's voice droned on. His Majesty's late sloop Sophie having been ordered to proceed. And whereas it is represented that in or about 40 minutes west, 37 degrees, 40 minutes north, Cape Roig bearing, he said amidst universal indifference. That man loves his trade, thought Stephen. But what a wretched vice. It is almost impossible to be understood. Gabble, a professional deformation in lawyers. And he was reflecting on industrial disease, on the corrosive effects of righteousness in judges, when he noticed that Jack had relaxed from his first rigid posture. And as the formalities went on, this relaxation became more evident. He was looking sullen, oddly still and dangerous. The slight lowering of his head and the dogged way in which he stuck out his feet made a singular contrast with the perfection of his uniform, and Stephen had a strong premonition that disaster might be very close at hand. The judge advocate had now reached to inquire into the conduct of John Aubrey, commander of His Majesty's late sloop the Sophie and her officers and company, for the loss of the said sloop by being captured on the third instant by a French squadron under the command of Admiral Lenoir. And Jack's head was lower still. How far is one entitled to manipulate one's friends? Asked Stephen. Writing, nothing would give H greater pleasure than an outburst of indignation on your part at this moment. On a corner of his paper. He passed it to the master, pointing to Jack. Marshall passed it on by way of Dalziel. Jack read it, turned a lowering, grim face without much apparent understanding in it towards Stephen, and gave a jerk of his head. Almost immediately afterwards, Charles Sterling, the senior captain and president of the court-martial, cleared his throat and said, Captain Aubrey, pray relate the circumstances of the loss of His Majesty's late sloop, the Sophie. Jack rose to his feet, looked sharply along the line of his judges, drew his breath, and speaking in a much stronger voice than usual, the words coming fast with odd intervals and an unnatural intonation, a harsh, God-damn-you voice, as though he were addressing a most inimical body of men, he said, At about 6 o'clock in the morning of the third to the eastward and in sight of Cape Roig, we saw three large ships, apparently French, and a frigate who soon after gave chase to the Sophie. The Sophie was between the shore and the ships that chased her and to windward of the French vessels. We endeavoured by making all sail, and were pulling with sweeps, as the wind was very light, to keep to windward of the enemy. But having found, notwithstanding all our endeavours to keep to the wind, that the French ships gained very fast, and having separated on different tacks, one or the other gained upon each shift of wind, and finding it impracticable to escape by the wind, about 9 o'clock the guns and other things on deck were thrown overboard. And having watched an opportunity when the nearest French ship was on our quarter, we bore up and set the studding sails, but again found the French ship outsailed as though her studding sails were not set. When the nearest ship had approached within musket shot, I ordered the colours to be hauled down about 11 o'clock a.m., the wind being to the eastward, and having received several broadsides from the enemy which carried away the main topgallant mast and fore topsail yard and cut several of the ropes. Then, though he was conscious of the singular ineptitude of this speech, he shut his mouth tight and stood looking straight ahead of him, while the clerk's pen squeaked nimbly after his words, writing and cut several of the ropes. Here there was a slight pause, in which the president glanced left and right and coughed again before speaking. The clerk drew a quick flourish after ropes and hurried on. Question by the court. Captain Aubrey, have you any reason to find fault with any of your officers or ship's company? Answer, no. The utmost endeavour was used by every person on board. Question by the court. Officers and ship's company of the Sophie, have any of you reason to find fault with the conduct of your captain? Answer, no. Let all the evidence withdraw, except Lieutenant Alexander Dalziel, said the judge advocate. And presently the midshipman, the master, and Stephen found themselves in the dining cabin again, sitting perfectly mute in odd corners, while from the one side the distant shrieking of the parson echoed up from the cockpit. He had made a determined attempt at suicide. And from the other, the drone of the trial went on. They were all deeply affected by Jack's concern, anxiety, and rage. They had seen him unmoved so often and in such circumstances that his present emotion shook them profoundly and disturbed their judgment. They could hear his voice now, formal, savage, and much louder than the rest of the voices in the court, saying, "Did the enemy fire several broadsides at us, and at what distance were we when they fired the last?" Mr. Dalziel's reply was a murmur, indistinguishable through the bulkhead. "This is an entirely irrational fear," said Stephen Maturin, looking at his wet and clammy palm. "It is but one more instance of... For surely, to God, surely for all love, if they'd wished to sink him, they would have asked, 'How came you to be there?' But then I know very little of nautical affairs." He looked for comfort at the master's face, but he found none there. "Dr. Maturin," said the marine, opening the door. Stephen walked in slowly and took the oath with particular deliberation, trying to sense the atmosphere of the court. He thus gave the clerk time to catch up with Dalziel's evidence, and the shrill pen wrote, "Question. Did she gain on the Sophie without her studding sail set? Answer, yes. Question by the court, did they seem to sail much faster than you? Answer, yes, both by and large. Dr. Maturin, surgeon of the Sophie, called and sworn. Question by the court. Is the statement you heard made by your captain respecting the loss of the Sophie correct as far as your observation went? Answer, I think it is. Question by the court. Are you a sufficient judge of nautical affairs to know whether every effort was used to escape from the force that was pursuing the Sophie? Answer, I know very little of nautical affairs, but it appeared to me that every exertion was used by every person on board. I saw the captain at the helm and the officers and ship's company at the sweeps. Question by the court. Was you on deck at the time the colours were struck? And what distance were the enemy from you at the time of her surrender? Answer. I was on deck, and the Desaix was within musket shot of the Sophie, and was firing at us at the time. 10 minutes later, the court was cleared. The dining cabin again, and no hesitation about precedence in the doorway this time, for Jack and Mr. Dalziel were there. They were all there, and not one of them spoke a word. Could that be laughter in the next room? Or did the sound come from the wardroom of the Caesar? A long pause. A long, long pause. And the marine at the door. If you please, gentlemen. They filed in, and in spite of all his years at sea, Jack forgot to duck. He struck the lintel of the door with a force that left a patch of yellow hair and scalp on the wood, and he walked on, almost blinded, to stand rigidly by his chair. The clerk looked up from writing the word sentence, startled by the crash, and then looked down again to commit the judge advocate's words to writing. At a court-martial assembled and held on board His Majesty's ship Pompey in Rosia Bay, the court, first being duly sworn, proceeded in pursuance of an order from Sir James Sumarez, Baronet, Rear Admiral of the Blue, and having examined witnesses on the occasion and maturely and deliberately considered every circumstance. The droning, expressionless voice went on, and its tone was so closely allied to the ringing in Jack's head that he heard virtually none of it, any more than he could see the man's face through the watering of his eyes. The court is of the opinion that Captain Aubrey, his officers and ship's company, used every possible exertion to prevent the King's sloop from falling into the hands of the enemy, and do therefore honourably acquit them, and they are hereby acquitted accordingly, said the judge advocate. And Jack heard none of it. The inaudible voice stopped, and Jack's blurred vision saw the black form sit down. He shook his singing head, tightened his jaw, and compelled his faculties to return. For here was the president of the court getting to his feet. Jack's clearing eyes caught Keats' smile, saw Captain Stirling pick up that familiar, rather shabby sword, holding it with its hilt towards him, while with his left hand he smoothed a piece of paper by the inkwell. The president cleared his throat again in the dead silence, and speaking in a clear, seaman-like voice that combined gravity, formality, and cheerfulness, he said, Captain Aubrey, it is no small pleasure to me to receive the commands of the court I have the honour to preside at, that, in delivering to you your sword, I should congratulate you upon its being restored by both friend and foe alike, hoping ere long you will be called upon to draw it once more in the honourable defence of your country.
The End.